This is Audible.
Welcome to the Audio Renaissance presentation of Healing Back Pain, The Mind-Body Connection, written by John E. Sarno, M.D., adapted for audio by David Smith. Produced by Paul Rubin. Final production supervised by Jill Whitesides. And now, here is Dr. John E. Sarno.
Hello. Before I begin, it's important for you to know that you should not conclude that you have the disorder described in this program unless you have been thoroughly studied by your regular doctor and he's ruled out all serious conditions. I do not see patients in my practice unless that has been done. While it is true that most of the common pain experiences people have appear to be due to the disorder I am about to describe, one must be absolutely sure that nothing serious is going on. I have rarely seen a patient with pain in the neck, shoulders, back, or buttocks who didn't believe that the pain was due to an injury, a hurt brought on by some physical activity. I hurt myself while running. The pain started after I lifted my little girl, or when I tried to open a stuck window. Or perhaps 10 years ago I was involved in a hit-from-behind auto accident, and I've had recurrent back pain ever since. The idea that pain means injury or damage is deeply ingrained in the American consciousness. Of course, if the pain starts while one is engaged in a physical activity, it's difficult not to attribute the pain to that activity. But this pervasive concept of the vulnerability of the back, of ease of injury, is nothing less than a medical catastrophe for the American public. We now have an army of semi-disabled men and women whose lives are significantly restricted by the fear of doing further damage or bringing on the dreaded pain again. One often hears, "I'm afraid of hurting myself again, so I'm going to be very careful of what I do." In good faith, this idea has been fostered by the medical profession and other healers for years. It has been assumed, without scientific validation of these diagnostic concepts, that neck, shoulder, back, and buttock pain is due to injury or disease of the spine and associated structures, or due to incompetence of muscles and ligaments surrounding these structures. On the other hand, I have had gratifying success in the treatment of these disorders for 27 years, based on a very different diagnosis. It has been my observation that the majority of these pain syndromes are the result of a condition in the muscles, or nerves, or tendons brought on by tension. And the point has been proven by the very high rate of success achieved with a treatment program that is simple, rapid, and thorough. Medicine's preoccupation with the spine draws on fundamental medical philosophy and training. Modern medicine has been primarily mechanical and structural in orientation. The body is viewed as an exceedingly complex machine, and illness is seen as a malfunction in the machine, brought about by infection, trauma, inherited defects, degeneration, and of course, cancer. At the same time, medical science has had a love affair with the laboratory, believing that nothing is valid unless it can be demonstrated in that arena. No one would dispute the essential role the laboratory has played in medical progress. Witness penicillin and insulin, for example. Unfortunately, some things are difficult to study at the laboratory. One of these is the mind and its organ, the brain. The emotions do not lend themselves to test tube experiments and measurement, and so modern medical science has chosen to ignore them, buttressed by the conviction that emotions have little to do with health and illness anyway. My concept currently is that rage in the unconscious, which incidentally I believe to be universal in our society, is the emotion that necessitates physical symptoms like pain. The purpose of the pain is to make sure that the rage does not escape repression and become overt, Anxiety and depression are equivalents to the pain, since they too are reactions to the unconscious rage. The same may be said for phobias, panic reactions, and obsessive-compulsive disorders, also equivalents of the pain, reactions to the unconscious rage. Still, the majority of practicing physicians do not consider that emotions play a significant role in causing physical disorders, though many would acknowledge that they might aggravate a physically caused illness. In general, physicians feel uncomfortable in dealing with a problem that is related to the emotions. They tend to make a sharp division between the things of the mind and the things of the body, and only feel comfortable with the latter. Peptic ulcer of the duodenum is a good example. Although most physicians would claim that peptic ulcers are due to bacteria, it is my view that emotional factors are still the precipitating cause of the ulcer, and that the presence of bacteria is only part of the process. Contrary to logic, however, the major focus in treatment is medical, not psychological, and drugs are prescribed to neutralize or prevent the secretion of acid. But failure to treat the primary cause of the disorder is poor medicine. It is symptomatic treatment, something we were warned about in medical school. But since most physicians see their role only as treating the body, the psychological part of the problem is neglected, even though it's the basic cause. In fairness, some physicians make an attempt to say something about tension, but it's often of a superficial nature, like, you ought to take it easy. You're working too hard. Pain syndromes look so physical. It is especially difficult for doctors to consider the possibility that they might be caused by psychological factors, and so they cling to the structural explanation. In doing so, however, they are chiefly responsible for the pain epidemic that now exists in this country. If structural abnormalities don't cause pain in the neck, shoulder, back, and buttocks, what does? Studies and clinical experience of many years suggest that these common pain syndromes are the result of a physiologic alteration in certain muscles, nerves, tendons, and ligaments. This alteration is called the tension myositis syndrome, or TMS. Myo means muscle. Tension myositis syndrome is defined here as a change of state in a muscle or nerve or tendon that is painful. It's a harmless but potentially very painful disorder that is the result of specific common emotional situations. It's the purpose of this program to describe TMS in detail. Who gets TMS? One might almost say that TMS is a cradle-to-grave disorder, since it does occur in children, though probably not until the age of 5 or 6. Its manifestation in children is, of course, different from what occurs in adults. I'm convinced that what are referred to as growing pains in children are manifestations of TMS. The cause of growing pains has never been identified, but physicians have always been comfortable in reassuring mothers that the condition is harmless. It occurred to me one day while listening to a young mother describe the severe leg pain her daughter had suffered in the middle of the night that what the child had experienced was very much like an adult attack of sciatica. And since this was clearly one of the most common manifestations of TMS, growing pains might very well represent TMS in children. Little wonder that no one has been able to explain the nature of growing pains, since TMS is a condition that usually leaves no physical evidence of its presence. There is a temporary constriction of blood vessels, bringing on the symptoms, and then all returns to normal. The emotional stimulus for the attack in children is no different from that in adults, something psychological. One might say that the attack in a child is a paranightmare. It is a substitute for a nightmare, a command decision by the mind to produce a physical reaction, rather than have the individual experience a painful emotion, which is what happens in adults as well. At the other end of the spectrum, I have seen the syndrome in men and women in their 80s. There appears to be no age limit. And why would there be? As long as one can generate emotions, one is susceptible to the disorder. What are the ages when it is most common, and can we learn anything from those statistics? In a follow-up survey carried out in 1982, 177 patients were interviewed as to their then-current status following treatment for TMS. We learned that 77% of the patients fell between the ages of 30 and 60. 9% were in their 20s. Only 2% were teenagers. At the other end of the spectrum, 7% were in their 60s and 4% in their 70s. These statistics suggest very strongly that the cause of most back pain is emotional, for the years between 30 and 60 are the ages that fall into what I would call the years of responsibility. This is the period in one's life when one is under the most strain to succeed, to provide and excel, and it's logical that this is when one would experience the highest incidence of TMS. Further, if degenerative changes in the spine, like osteoarthritis, disc degeneration and herniation, facet arthrosis and spinal stenosis, if these were a primary cause of back pain, these statistics wouldn't fit at all. In that case, a gradual increase in incidence from the 20s on would occur, with the highest incidence in the oldest people. To be sure, this is only circumstantial evidence, but it is highly suggestive. So the answer to the question, who gets TMS, is anybody. But it is certainly most common in the middle years of life, the years of responsibility. Let's take a look at how TMS manifests itself. The primary tissue involved in TMS is muscle, hence the original name myositis. Remember, myo stands for muscle. The only muscles in the body that are susceptible to TMS are those in the back of the neck, the entire back, and the buttocks, known collectively as postural muscles. They are so named because they maintain the correct posture of the head and trunk and contribute to the effective use of the arms. Postural muscles have a higher proportion of slow twitch muscle fibers than arm or leg muscles. This makes them more efficient for endurance activity, which is what is required of them. Whether or not this is the reason why TMS is restricted to this group of muscles, we do not know. It is possible, though, since the muscles most frequently involved have the most important jobs. These are the buttock muscles, known anatomically as gluteal muscles. Their job is to keep the trunk upright on the legs, to prevent it from falling forward or to either side. Statistically, the low back buttock area is the most common location for TMS. Just above the buttocks are the lumbar muscles in the small of the back, often involved simultaneously with buttock muscles. Occasionally, the gluteal or lumbar muscles are affected separately. Roughly two-thirds of TMS patients will have their major pain in this area. Second in order of frequency of involvement are the neck and shoulder muscles. The pain is usually in the side of the neck and the top of the shoulder in the upper trapezius muscle. TMS can occur anywhere else in the back between the shoulders and low back, but does so far less frequently than in the two areas I mentioned. Generally, a patient will complain of pain in one of these prime areas, as, for example, in the left buttock or the right shoulder, but the physical examination will reveal something else of great interest and importance. In virtually every patient with TMS, one finds tenderness when pressure is applied to muscles in three parts of the back: the outer aspect of both buttocks, and sometimes to the entire buttock, the muscles in the lumbar area, and both upper trapezius or shoulder muscles. This consistent pattern is important because it supports the hypothesis that the pain syndrome originates in the brain rather than in some structural abnormality of the spine or incompetence of the muscle. The second type of tissue to be implicated in this syndrome is nerve tissue, specifically what are known as peripheral nerves. Those most frequently affected are located, as might be expected, in close proximity to the muscles that are involved most often. The sciatic nerve is located deep in the buttock muscle, one on each side. Lumbar spinal nerves are under the lumbar paraspinal muscles. The cervical spinal nerves and brachial plexus are under the upper trapezius muscles. These are the nerves most frequently affected in TMS. In fact, TMS looks like a regional process, rather than one aimed at specific structures. So when it affects a given area, all the tissues suffer oxygen deprivation so that one may experience both muscle and nerve pain. Varying kinds of pain may result when muscle and/or nerve are affected. It may be sharp, aching, burning, shock-like, or it may feel like pressure. In addition to pain, nerve involvement may produce feelings of pins and needles, tingling and/or numbness, and sometimes sensations of weakness in the legs or arms. In some cases, there is measurable muscle weakness. This can be documented with electromyographic studies. Electromyographic or EMG abnormalities are often cited as evidence of nerve damage due to structural compression, but in fact, EMG changes are very common in TMS and usually reveal involvement of many more nerves than could be explained by a structural abnormality. Lumbar spinal and sciatic nerve symptoms are in the legs, for that is where those nerves are going. Involvement of cervical spinal nerves and brachial plexus cause symptoms in the arms and hands. Traditional diagnoses attribute leg pain to a herniated disc and arm pain to a, quote, pinched nerve. TMS may involve any of the nerves in the neck, shoulders, back, and buttocks, sometimes producing unusual pain patterns. One of the most frightening is chest pain. One immediately thinks of the heart when there is chest pain, and indeed, it is always important to be sure that there's nothing wrong with that organ. Once having done so, one should keep in mind that spinal nerves in the upper back may be suffering mild oxygen deprivation because of TMS, and that this may be the source of the pain. These nerves serve the front of the trunk as well as the back, hence the chest pain. Remember, always consult a regular physician in order to rule out serious disorders. This program is not intended as a guide to self-diagnosis. Its purpose is to describe a clinical entity, TMS. One may suspect the presence of nerve involvement in TMS through the patient's history, a physical examination, or both. Sciatic pain may affect any part of the leg except the upper front thigh. There is considerable variability depending on how much of the nerve trunk is affected by oxygen debt. As noted, the person may also complain of other strange feelings and of weakness. On physical examination, the tendon reflexes and muscle strength are tested to determine whether oxygen deprivation has irritated the nerve sufficiently to interfere with the transmission of motor impulses. Similarly, sensory tests are done, for example, ability to feel a pinprick, to determine the integrity of the sensory fibers in the involved nerve. The major virtue of documenting sensory or motor deficits is to be able to discuss them with patients and reassure them that feelings of weakness, numbness, or tingling are quite harmless. The so-called straight leg raising test is always done when a patient is examined, though for different reasons depending on the examiner. If there is a great deal of soreness in the buttocks, the patient will be unable to elevate the straightened leg very far, and then only with a great deal of pain. The pain may be due to the muscle, the sciatic nerve, or both. What the sign does not mean in the majority of cases is that there is a herniated disc, quote, pressing on the sciatic nerve, as patients are often told. When there is a shoulder arm pain syndrome, one does similar tests on the arm and hand. Sometimes patients have pain on two sides. This is of no particular significance. People will also often report that in addition to having the major pain in the right buttock and leg, for example, they have some intermittent pain in the neck or one of the shoulders. This is not unexpected, since TMS may involve any or all of the postural muscles. Following the publication of my first book describing TMS, I gradually became aware that a variety of tendinalgias, pain in tendons or ligaments, were probably part of the syndrome of tension myositis. The term myositis was fast becoming obsolete, it having been determined many years before that nerves could be implicated in TMS, as just described. Now I was beginning to realize that still another type of tissue might be part of the process. And as time went by, this conclusion became more and more inescapable. What first attracted attention were reports from treated patients. In addition to the disappearance of back pain, their tendon pain, for example, tennis elbow, often went as well. As is well known, tennis elbow was one of the most common of the disorders called tendinitis. Generally, it is assumed that these painful tendons are inflamed, probably because of excessive activity. The routine treatment is anti-inflammatory medication and activity restriction. Having been alerted to the possibility that these painful tendons might be part of TMS, I began to suggest to patients that their tendinitis might also disappear if they allowed it to occupy the same place in their thinking as the back pain. The results were encouraging, and over time, my confidence in the diagnosis increased. I am now prepared to say that tendinalgia is often an integral part of TMS, and in some cases is its primary manifestation. It has become apparent that the elbow is not the most common site of tendinalgia. In my experience, the knee has that distinction. Some of the usual diagnoses for knee pain are chondromalacia, unstable kneecap, trauma, and a torn cartilage. However, the examination discloses that there is tenderness of one or more of the tendons and ligaments surrounding the knee joint, and the pain usually disappears along with the back pain. Another common place is the foot and ankle, either the top or bottom of the foot, or the Achilles tendon. Common foot diagnoses are neuroma, bone spur, plantar fasciitis, flat feet, and trauma due to excessive physical activity. The shoulder is another location for TMS tendinalgia. The usual structural diagnosis is bursitis or rotator cuff disorder. Again, there is usually easily identified tenderness on palpation of a tendon in the shoulder. Wrist tendons are not uncommonly involved. It is likely that what is known as carpal tunnel syndrome may also be part of TMS. Recently, I saw a patient who had developed pain in a new location after a minor accident. She said that the pain was in her hip, and that x-rays showed that there was arthritis of the hip joints, more on the side where she was having pain. She had been told that this was the cause of her pain. She had proven to be highly susceptible to TMS in the past, so I suggested she come in for an examination. The x-rays showed a very modest amount of arthritic change in the joint in question. She had excellent range of motion of the joint and no pain on weight-bearing or movement of the leg. When I asked her to touch the exact spot where she felt the pain, she identified a small area where the tendon of a muscle attaches to bone, well above the hip joint. It was tender to pressure. I told her I thought she had TMS tendinalgia, and the pain left in a few days. TMS can manifest itself in a variety of locations, and it tends to move around, particularly if something is being done to combat the disorder. Patients often report pain in a new location as the old one gets better. It is as though the brain is unwilling to give up this convenient strategy for diverting attention away from the realm of the emotions. It is therefore particularly important for the patient to know where all the possible locations of pain are. My patients are routinely instructed to call me when they develop new pain so that we can determine whether it is part of TMS. In summary, TMS involves three types of tissue: muscle, nerve, and tendon-ligaments. Let us now look at how TMS manifests itself. When first seen, most people are under the impression that they have been suffering from the long-term results of an injury, a degenerative process, a congenital abnormality, or some deficiency in the strength or flexibility of their muscles. The idea of injury is probably the most pervasive. This often ties in with the circumstances under which the pain begins. According to a survey we did a number of years ago, 40% of a typical group of patients reported that the pain began in association with some kind of physical incident. For some, it was a minor automobile accident, usually the hit from behind type. Falls on the ice or down steps were common. Lifting a heavy object or straining was another. And, of course, running, tennis, golf, or basketball were often blamed. The pain began anywhere from minutes to hours or days after the incident, raising some important questions about the nature of the pain. Some of the reported incidents were trivial, such as bending over to pick up a toothbrush or twisting to reach into a cupboard. But the ensuing pain might be just as excruciating as that experienced by someone who is trying to lift a refrigerator. I recall a young man who was sitting at his office desk writing and experienced a spasm in his low back so severe and persistent that he had to be taken home by ambulance. The next 48 hours were agonizing. He couldn't move without setting off a new wave of spasm. How can such excruciating pain be set off by this great variety of physical incidents? In view of the different degrees of severity of the physical incidents and the great variation in when the pain begins after the incident, the conclusion is that the physical happening was not the cause of the pain, but was merely a trigger. Many patients apparently don't need a trigger. The pain just comes on gradually, or they awaken with it in the morning. In the survey mentioned above, 60% fell into that category. The idea that physical incidents are triggers is reinforced by the fact that there is no way to distinguish between those pains that start gradually and those that begin dramatically in terms of subsequent severity or longevity of the attack. All of this makes perfect sense when one considers the nature of TMS. Despite the perception of injury, patients are not injured. The physical occurrence has given the brain the opportunity to begin an attack of TMS. There is another reason to doubt the role of injury in these attacks of back pain. One of the most powerful systems that has evolved over the millions of years of life on this planet is the biologic capacity for healing, for restoration. Our body parts tend to heal very quickly when they are injured. Even the largest bone in the body, the femur, only takes 6 weeks to heal. And during that process, there is pain for only a very short time. It is illogical to think that an injury that occurred 2 months ago might still be causing pain, not to mention 1 or 2 or 10 years ago. And yet people have been so thoroughly indoctrinated with the idea of persistent injury that they accept it without question. Invariably, those patients who have a gradual onset of pain will attribute it to a physical incident that may have occurred years before, like an automobile or skiing accident, because in their minds, back pain is physical, that is, structural. It must be due to an injury. As far as they are concerned, there has to be a physical cause. This idea is one of the great impediments in the way of recovery. It must be resolved in the patient's mind or the pain will persist. Gradually, patients need to begin to think psychologically. And, indeed, once the diagnosis of TMS is made, it is common for patients to begin to recall all of the psychological things that were going on in their lives when acute attacks occurred, like starting a new job, getting married, an illness in the family, a financial crisis, and so on. Or, the patient will acknowledge that he or she has always been a worrier, overly conscientious and responsible, compulsive and perfectionistic, Antor has a strong need to be liked and to be helpful to others. This is the beginning of wisdom, the start of the process of putting things into proper perspective. In this case, it is the recognition that there are physical disorders that play a psychological role in human biology. Not to be aware of that fact is to doom oneself to perpetual pain and disability. Perhaps the most common and undoubtedly the most frightening manifestation of TMS is the acute attack. It usually comes out of the blue, and the pain is often excruciating. The most common location for these attacks is the low back, involving the lumbar muscles at the small of the back, the buttock muscles, or both. Any movement brings on a new wave of terrible pain, so the condition is very upsetting, to say the least. It is clear that the involved muscles have gone into spasm. Spasm is a state of extreme contraction of the muscles, an abnormal condition that may be horrifically painful. Most everyone has experienced a leg or foot cramp, a Charlie horse, which is the same thing, except that the cramp will stop as soon as the involved muscle is stretched. The spasm of an attack of TMS does not let up. When it begins to ease, any movement can start it up again. I believe that oxygen deprivation is responsible for the spasm as well as other kinds of pain characteristic of TMS. It is likely that leg cramps also result from oxygen deprivation. This is why they usually occur in bed when the circulation of blood is slowed down and there is liable to be a temporary minor state of reduced oxygenation in the leg muscles. Blood flow can be quickly restored to normal with muscle contraction. With TMS, however, reduced blood flow is continued by action of the autonomic nerves and the abnormal muscle state persists. People often report that at the moment of onset they hear some kind of noise, a crack, a snap, or a pop. Patients often use the phrase, "My back went out." They're sure that something is broken. In fact, nothing breaks, but the patient will swear that there has been some kind of structural damage. The noise is a mystery. It may be that it is similar to the noise elicited by a manipulation of the spine, which is a kind of cracking the knuckles of the joints of the spinal bones. One thing is clear. The noise indicates nothing harmful. Though the lower back is the most common location for an acute attack, it can occur anywhere in the neck, shoulders, or upper and lower back. Wherever it occurs, it is the most painful thing I know of in clinical medicine, which is ironic, because it is completely harmless. Not uncommonly, the trunk is distorted by one of these attacks. It may be bent forward, or to the side, or a bit of both. It is undoubtedly an automatic reaction to the pain. Naturally, it's very disturbing, but it has no special significance. These episodes last for varying periods of time and invariably leave the person with a sense of dread and apprehension. The common perception is that something terrible has happened and that it is important to be very careful not to do anything that will injure the back and bring on another attack. If the low back pain is accompanied by pain in the leg or sciatica, there is even greater concern and apprehension, for this raises the specter of herniated disc and the possibility of surgery. In this media-dominated age, very few people have not heard of herniated discs, and the idea arouses great anxiety, resulting in greater pain. If, in the course of medical investigation, imaging studies show a herniation, the apprehension is multiplied even further. And if there should be feelings of numbness or tingling in the leg or foot, and/or weakness, all of which can occur with TMS, because of burgeoning fear, the conditions for a very protracted episode of pain are defined. As we'll discuss later, herniated discs are rarely the cause of the pain. There is not a great deal one can do to speed the resolution of such an episode. If the person is fortunate enough to know what is going on, that this is only a muscle spasm and there is nothing structurally wrong, the attack will be short-lived. but this is rarely the case. I advise my patients to remain quietly in bed, perhaps take a strong painkiller, and not agonize over what has happened. They are further instructed to keep testing their ability to move around and not assume that they're going to be immobilized for days or weeks. If one can overcome one's apprehension, the duration of the attack will be considerably shorter. In over half the cases of TMS, the pain begins gradually. There is no dramatic episode. In some cases, there is no physical incident to which one can attribute the pain. In others, onset of pain may follow a physical happening, but hours, days, or even weeks later. This pattern is fairly common after a so-called whiplash incident. Your car is struck from behind, and your head snaps back. Examination and x-rays do not reveal a fracture or dislocation, but sometime thereafter pain begins, usually in the neck and shoulders, occasionally in the mid or low back. Pain in an arm or hand may also occur. And, like sciatica, this pain arouses a great deal of anxiety. Sometimes the pain begins in the neck and shoulders and then moves down to involve the rest of the back. If one knows that this is TMS, the course may be relatively brief. If some sort of structural diagnosis is made, symptoms may continue for many months despite treatment. Whether acute attack or slow onset, why does the pain begin when it does? Remember, the physical incident, no matter how dramatic, is a trigger. The answer, of course, is to be found in one's psychological state. Sometimes the reason is obvious, a financial or health crisis, or something one ordinarily thinks of as a happy occasion, like getting married or the birth of a child. I've had a number of highly competitive people whose pain began in the course of athletic competition, like a tennis match. Naturally, they assumed that they had hurt themselves. When they realized they had TMS, they admitted how very anxious they had been about the competition. It is not the occasion itself, but the emotional reaction which it generates that determines if there will be a physical reaction. The important thing is the emotion generated and repressed, for we have a built-in tendency to repress unpleasant, painful, or embarrassing emotions. These repressed feelings are the stimulus for TMS and other disorders like it. Experience has shown that rage is the most important emotion that we would rather not be aware of, and so the mind keeps it in the subterranean precincts of the unconscious mind if it possibly can. Then there's the person who says, "There was absolutely nothing going on in my life when this began." But when we begin to discuss the trials and tribulations of daily life, it is usually clear that this person is generating unconscious emotions all the time. I think there is a gradual build-up in such people until a threshold is reached, at which point the symptoms begin. Once it is pointed out to them, these patients have little trouble recognizing that they are the kind of goodist or perfectionist, highly responsible people who generate a lot of unconscious anger in response to the pressures of everyday life. There is another interesting pattern that we see very often, which is the delayed onset reaction. In these cases, patients go through a highly stressful period that may last for weeks or months, such as an illness in the family or a financial crisis. They are physically fine as they live through the trouble, but 1 or 2 weeks after it's all over, they have an attack of back pain, either acute or slow onset. It seems as though they rise to the occasion and do whatever they have to do to deal with the trouble. But once it's over, the accumulated anger slash rage threatens to overwhelm them, and so the pain begins. Another way of looking at it is that they don't have time to be sick during the crisis. All of their emotional energy goes into coping with the trouble. A third possibility is that the crisis or stressful situation is providing enough emotional pain and distraction that a physical pain isn't necessary. The pain syndrome seems to function to divert the person's attention away from repressed, undesirable emotions like rage. When one is living through a crisis, there is more than enough unpleasantness going on, and one has no need for a distraction. Whatever the psychological explanation, this is a common pattern, and it is important to recognize it so that the back pain will not be blamed on some, quote, physical condition. When we generate anger, depends mostly on the details of our personality structure. Some people report that they almost always have an attack of pain when they're on vacation. Or if they already have pain, they'll report that it gets worse on weekends. For some, the reason is obvious. They are very anxious about their work or business when they're away from it. It's a bit like the delayed reaction. As long as they are on the job, they may be burning up the tension. But when they are away from it, supposedly relaxing, the tension accumulates. Speaking of relaxing, one often hears the advice, relax, as though that's something one can do voluntarily. There are also numerous techniques around for promoting relaxation, like drugs, meditation, and biofeedback, to name a few. However, unless the relaxation process succeeds in reducing repressed anger, people will develop things like TMS and tension headaches despite the attempt to induce relaxation. Some people don't know how to leave their daily concerns behind them and shift attention to something pleasurable. I remember a patient who said that her pain would invariably begin when she got herself a drink and sat down to relax. Essential to an understanding of TMS and what happens over time if one continues to be plagued by this disorder is knowledge about a very important phenomenon known as conditioning. A more modern term meaning the same thing is programming. All animals, including humans, are conditionable. The phenomenon is best known by the experiment reported by the Russian physiologist Pavlov, who is credited with the discovery of conditioning. One of his experiments demonstrated that animals develop associations which can produce automatic and reproducible physical reactions. In the research study, he rang a bell each time he fed a group of dogs. After repeating this a few times, he found that the dogs would salivate if he rang the bell, even without the presentation of food. They had become conditioned to have a physical reaction at the sound of the bell. The process of conditioning or programming seems to be very important in determining when the person with TMS will have pain. For example, a common complaint of people with low back pain is that it is invariably brought on by sitting. This is such a benign activity, one is mystified by the fact that it initiates pain. But conditioning occurs when two things go on simultaneously. So it is easy to imagine that at some point early in the course of the TMS experience, the person happens to be having pain while sitting. The brain makes the association between sitting and the presence of pain, and that person is now programmed to expect pain with sitting. In other words, the pain occurs because of its unconscious association with sitting, not because sitting is bad for the back. That is one way a conditioned response may be established. Car seats have a bad reputation, so a person expects to have pain when he or she gets into a car. Often, people are programmed to have pain because of things they've heard or things they've been told by a practitioner. Never bend at the waist means the onset of pain is a sure thing when they bend from then on, although it may never have caused pain before. Someone says that sitting compresses the lower end of the spine. So, of course, it's got to hurt when you sit. Standing in one place, lifting, carrying, all have a bad reputation and will quickly be conditioned into a patient's pattern. Many people report that the pain is relieved by walking. Others say that walking brings it on. Some have a great deal of pain at night and cannot sleep. One man worked hard all day long with a fair amount of heavy lifting and never a twinge of pain. Every night, He would wake up about 3 a.m. with severe pain that persisted until he got out of bed. Clearly, a conditioned reaction. Others report that they sleep well, but develop pain as soon as they wake up and get out of bed. In these patients, the pain usually increases in severity as the day goes on. Based on history and physical examination, all of these people have TMS, but are programmed to believe they suffer from something else. What gives strong support to the idea that these reactions are conditioned is that they disappear within a few weeks as patients go through my treatment program. If they were structurally based, they would not go away after treatment consisting primarily of lecture seminars, but this is what happens with successfully treated patients. The conditioning is broken by the educational process. One cannot overemphasize the importance of conditioning in TMS, for it explains many of the reactions that patients don't understand. If someone says, "I can lift a very light weight, but anything over 5 pounds will cause pain," the pain can't be based on structural grounds. Or this example, a woman who could bend over and touch her palms to the floor without pain, but told me she always felt pain when she put her shoes on. Many of these conditioned responses stem from the fear that people develop when they have back pain, especially in the low back. They have been told and they have read that the back is fragile, vulnerable, and easily injured. So if they try to do something vigorous like jog or swim or vacuum a carpet, their backs begin to hurt. They have learned to associate activity with pain. They expect it, so it happens. That is conditioning. The specific posture or activity that brings on the pain is not important per se. What is essential is to know that it has been programmed in as part of the TMS and is therefore of psychological rather than physical significance. Perhaps the most common pattern is for the person to have recurrent acute attacks of the kind I've described. These may last from days to weeks or even months, with the most acute pain subsiding after a few days. They are traditionally treated with bed rest, painkillers, and anti-inflammatory drugs. If the patient is hospitalized, traction is often employed, though its purpose is to immobilize the patient and not to pull the spinal bones apart, since this could not be done with the weights used. I do not instruct my patients what to do for an acute attack, for it is the goal of this program to see that the attacks don't occur, to prevent them. However, occasionally I am called upon to advise someone having an acute attack. As I stated earlier, it's essentially a question of waiting it out. I may prescribe a strong painkiller, but not an anti-inflammatory drug, since there is no inflammation. The irony of the usual experience with one of these attacks is that most patients would be better off if they consulted no one. This is unwise, however, because every once in a while there may be something physiologically important going on, and so one must be examined by a physician. Assuming nothing truly serious like a tumor is present, the usual diagnosis is some spinal structural abnormality. A scary diagnosis, such as degenerative disc disease, herniated disc, arthritis, spinal stenosis, or facet syndrome, plus the dire warnings of what will happen if the patient doesn't take sufficient bed rest, and cautioning about never again jogging or using a vacuum cleaner or bowling or playing tennis, this is the perfect combination for multiplied and persistent pain. But the human spirit is more or less indomitable, and eventually the symptoms fade, leaving someone who is essentially free of pain but permanently scarred, not physically, but emotionally. Except for the very brave few, most people who have had such an attack never again engage in vigorous physical activity with an easy mind. They have been sensitized by the experience and all that it is supposed to imply, and they see themselves to a greater or lesser degree, has permanently altered. They fear another attack. And eventually it comes. It may be 6 months or a year later, but the prophecy is fulfilled and the dreaded event occurs again. As before, the person usually attributes the attack to some physical incident. This time, there may be leg pain as well as back pain, and now there is talk of surgery should a herniated disc be found. This pattern of recurrence of acute attacks is very common. As time goes on, the attacks tend to come more frequently, to be more severe, and to last longer. And with each new attack, the fear increases, and there is an increased tendency to limit physical activities. Some patients become virtually disabled. In my view, physical restrictions and the fear of physical activity represent the worst aspect of these pain syndromes. They are ever present, though the pain may come and go. They have a profound effect on all aspects of life, work, family, leisure time. Indeed, I have known patients with TMS who were much more disabled in terms of their daily lives than patients who are paralyzed in both legs. Many of the latter go to work every day on their own, raise families, and in every way lead normal lives, except that they are in wheelchairs. The severe TMS patient may have to stay in bed most of the day because of the pain. Eventually, most people who have recurrent attacks will develop a chronic pattern. They will begin to have some pain all the time, usually mild, but exacerbated by a variety of activities or postures to which they have become conditioned. The kinds of statements I hear are, I can lie on my left side, but not on my right. I must always have a pillow between my knees and bed. I never go anywhere without my seat cushion. My neck collar is absolutely essential if I am to remain free of pain. If I sit for more than 5 minutes, I get severe pain. The only chair I can sit on has to have a hard seat and a straight back, and on and on and on. To some, the pain becomes the primary focus of their lives. It is not uncommon to hear people say that the pain is the first thing they are aware of when they awaken in the morning and the last thing they think about when they go to sleep. They become obsessed with it. There is great variety in the manifestations of TMS. There are those who have a little pain all the time with varying degrees of physical restriction. Others have occasional acute attacks, but live essentially normal lives in between with little or no restriction. What I have been describing are the most common manifestations of TMS and the most dramatic, those in the low back and legs. However, a severe episode involving the neck, shoulders, and arms can be very dramatic too, and just as physically restricting. To summarize, TMS may involve postural muscles, nerves that are in and around those muscles, and a variety of tendons and ligaments in the arms and legs. In the involved areas, the patient has pain, possibly feelings of pins and needles, and/or weakness. There are many different patterns and locations of symptoms, and considerable variation in severity, ranging from mild annoyance to almost total disability. Recurrent attacks, fear of recurrence and physical activity, and failure to find successful treatment characterize TMS. The symptoms of pain, numbness, tingling, and weakness are intended by the brain to suggest that something is physically wrong. To most people, practitioners and laymen alike, physically wrong means injury, weakness, incompetence, and degeneration, singly or in combination. To further this view of the symptoms, the pain often begins in association with some physical activity. The more vigorous, the better. The patient can't help but conclude that something has been injured or displaced. My back went out, is a common description of the event. Also very important to advancing the idea of structural incompetence is the powerful tendency for people to become programmed to fear a variety of simple, common things like sitting, standing in one place, bending and lifting. The net effect of symptoms, fears, and alterations in lifestyle and daily activities is to produce someone whose attention is strongly focused on the body. That is the purpose of the syndrome, to create a distraction so that undesirable emotions can be avoided and kept down. It seems a heavy price to pay, but then the inner workings of the mind are not really known, and we can only suspect its deep aversion to frightening, painful feelings. Neck, shoulder, and back pain syndromes are not mechanical problems to be cured by mechanical means. They have to do with people's feelings, their personalities, and the vicissitudes of life. If this is true, the conventional management of these pain syndromes is a medical travesty. Traditional medical diagnoses focus on the machine, the body, while the real problem seems to relate to what makes the machine work, the mind. TMS is characterized by physical pain, but that acute discomfort is induced by psychological phenomena rather than structural abnormalities or muscle deficiency. This is an exceedingly important point, and I will soon clarify just how this works. But first, a few definitions to be sure that the terms are clear. Tension is a word that is widely used and means different things to different people. In my work and in this audio program, the disorder is called the tension myositis syndrome. The word tension is used here to refer to emotions that are generated in the unconscious mind and that, to a large extent, remain there. These feelings are the result of a complicated interaction between different parts of our minds and between the mind and the outside world. Many of them are either unpleasant, painful, embarrassing, or even dangerous, and therefore unacceptable to us and or society, and so we repress them. Examples of such feelings are childishness or selfishness, low self-esteem, or feelings of inferiority. They are repressed because the mind doesn't want us to experience them, nor does it want them to be seen by the outside world. It is likely that if given a conscious choice, most of us would decide to deal with the bad feelings. But as the human mind is presently constituted, they are immediately and automatically repressed. One has no choice. To sum up, the word tension will be used here to refer to repressed, unacceptable emotions. The word stress is often confused with tension and seems to stand for anything that is emotionally negative. I like to use it to refer to any factor, influence, or condition that tests, strains, or in any way puts pressure on the individual. We can be stressed physically or emotionally. Excessive heat or cold are physical stressors. A demanding job or family problems are emotional ones. The stress involved in TMS leads to emotional reactions that are repressed. Stress can be either external or internal to the individual. Examples of external stress are your job, financial problems, illness, change of job or home, caring for children, or parents. However, the internal stressors appear to be more important in the production of tension. These are one's own personality attributes, like conscientiousness, perfectionism, the need to excel, and the need to be good. People often say they have a very stressful job, and that's why they're tense. But if they weren't conscientious about doing a good job, if they weren't trying to succeed, achieve, and excel, they wouldn't generate tension. Often such people are highly competitive and determined to get ahead. Typically, they are more critical of themselves than others are of them. A homemaker and mother with a similar personality stresses herself in the same way as someone in the work world. But the focus of her concerns is the family. She worries about her children, her husband, her parents. She wants the best for everyone and will do everything in her power to bring it about. She may also tell you that it is important to her that everyone like her, that she gets very upset if she feels that anyone is displeased with her. Stress, then, is outside what one might call the inner core of the emotional structure, and is composed of the stresses and strains of daily life and, more importantly, aspects of one's own personality. And stress leads to tension, repressed, unacceptable feelings. Now let's take a closer look at the personality. The part of your personality that you're aware of resides in the conscious mind. It's the realm of emotions you can feel. You feel sad, glad, exhilarated, depressed. You also know that you are conscientious, hardworking, a worrier, perhaps compulsive and perfectionistic. You may realize that you are often irritable, or you're aware of having a need to assert yourself. A man may have strong feelings of masculine superiority and be aware of it, indeed proud of it. These make up the conscious you, and they seem to determine what we do in life and how we conduct ourselves. But do they? Often these outward characteristics reflect inner drives of which we may be totally unaware. So it is important to look at the unconscious mind, as we shall do in a moment. The word unconscious has an unfortunate other use, that is, to be out of contact as in sleep or when brain damaged. However, it is firmly entrenched in the psychological literature as referring to that part of emotional activity of which we are usually unaware, and we should therefore use the word when discussing emotions. We would probably be more comfortable with the word subconscious, but it is not accurate to use it in this discussion. The unconscious is subterranean, the realm of the hidden and mysterious, and the place where all sorts of feelings may reside, not all logical, not all nice, and some of them downright scary. We get some hint of the kinds of things that inhabit the unconscious from our dreams. Someone said that every night when we go to sleep, we all go quietly and safely insane, because that's when the remnants of childish, primitive, wild behavior that are part of everyone's emotional repertoire can show themselves without being monitored by the waking conscious mind. The unconscious is the repository of all of our feelings, regardless of their social or personal acceptability. To know about the unconscious is extremely important, for what goes on down there may be responsible for those personality characteristics that drive us to behave as we do when we're awake. And the unconscious is where TMS and other disorders like it originate. To better understand how and why TMS gets started, it's essential to look at some of these unconscious emotional processes. I find it almost shocking to realize how common it is for people to have feelings of inferiority deep inside. I believe it is true for everyone, but in some it is worse than in others, probably because of bad experiences with parents during the growing up years. It is likely that for most of us, the compulsive need to do well, succeed, and achieve is a reflection of deep-seated feelings of inferiority. Wherever it comes from, the need to accomplish or live up to some ideal role, such as being the best parent, student, or worker, is very common in people who get TMS. A typical example was a patient who, through compulsive hard work, established a very successful business and became the patriarch and benefactor of his large family. He enjoyed the role, but felt the responsibility deeply. Throughout his entire adult life, he had low back pain, which resisted all attempts at treatment. By the time I saw him, the pain patterns were deeply ingrained and part of his everyday life. He understood the concept of tension-induced pain, but was unable to erase the patterns of a lifetime. He felt that he was too old to engage in psychotherapy, which is often required for patients like this. The primary benefit he derived from treatment was a reassurance that there was nothing structurally wrong with his back. People who get TMS are often intensely competitive, success-oriented, achieving, and usually very accomplished. In our culture, success often requires the ability to compete effectively, and they do. They are accustomed to putting a great deal of pressure on themselves and often feel as though they have not done enough. Often, they also feel that they have not been good enough. Sometimes the perfectionism manifests itself in unusual ways. I remember once seeing a young man who had grown up on a farm. He said that when he had read my first book, he didn't see how this perfectionism applied to him, until he realized that at haying time, he had a powerful compulsion to stack the bales of hay perfectly. At this point, you may be mentally scratching your head and wondering why being hardworking, conscientious, or compulsive and perfectionistic should bring on TMS. It is clear that there is a relationship between these personality characteristics and this pain syndrome, but what is it? To understand this, we need to think about anger and rage. Standing right beside the deeply buried feelings of low self-esteem is another of equal importance, narcissism. This refers to the human tendency to love oneself, that is, to be self-centered to an excessive degree. The evolution of culture in the United States seems to have produced people who are much more I than we oriented. I've heard it said that many of the American Indian languages had no pronouns for I and me because of a powerful sense of community and of being part of something larger than themselves. By contrast, contemporary North Americans believe in individualism and have great admiration for the person who goes it alone. But the other side of that coin is that the individual may become overly focused on himself and, if he is not motivated by lofty ideals, tend to greediness and avarice. Narcissism exists in all human beings to some degree. When it is strong, it can make trouble, since it means that the person is easily irritated, often frustrated by contact with others who do not do his bidding or do it badly. The result is anger, and if the person is very narcissistic, he or she may be angry all the time but never know it, because, like anxiety, it has been repressed. It's all there in the unconscious mind. Here's a seeming paradox. On the one hand, we have poor self-esteem, but then our narcissism leads us to behave emotionally like reigning monarchs. It's the story of the prince and the pauper. They are one and the same person. These diametrically different feelings are opposite sides of the same coin, though it may strike us as strange that they generally exist simultaneously. How typical of the human mind! It appears to be a storehouse of often conflicting feelings and tendencies, most of which we are totally unaware of. We are angry for other reasons. In fact, anything that makes us anxious, all unconscious, will tend to make us angry as well. You're trying to do a good job. You hope it turns out well. You're anxious, but you're also resentful of the problems with which you must contend. For example, other people and their needs. You're angry. Although the production of anxiety and anger is often work-related, personal relationships are an equally common source of repressed emotions. Family dynamics often produce serious problems that may be unrecognized because of their subtlety. One of my patients was a woman in her late 40s who'd had a sheltered adolescence, an early marriage, and, as dictated by her culture, thereafter had devoted herself exclusively to home and family. She did an excellent job, since she was an intelligent, competent, and compassionate woman. However, there came a time when she began to resent the fact that she had not been allowed to go to school as a child and could not read and write, could not drive a car, and had been denied many experiences because the needs of her family so dominated her life. She was totally unaware of the existence of this resentment, and as a consequence, developed a long, disabling history of back pain, including unsuccessful surgery. When she came to my attention, she was in constant pain and was almost totally unable to function. Through the education program and psychotherapy, she became aware of these repressed feelings, and the pain gradually disappeared. The process was not without psychological trauma, for now she was faced with the disapproval of her family and friends and her own deeply ingrained attitudes. She was in considerable conflict and now experienced emotional pain, but this was appropriate and vastly preferable to the physical pain of which she had been a helpless victim. An important source of anger and resentment, of which we are usually unaware, stems from our sense of responsibility to those who are close to us, like parents, spouses, and children. Though we love them, they may burden us in many ways, and the resultant anger is internalized. How can one be angry at elderly parents or a baby? A good example is the case of the young father whose firstborn turns out to be a non-sleeper. Not only does he lose sleep, but his wife is pretty much tied up with the baby around the clock. He has to pitch in during his free time. Their social life is much curtailed, and what was a long honeymoon before the baby came is now a grind. He develops back pain because he's mad at the baby. Ridiculous! And angry at his wife, because she can no longer minister to his emotional and physical needs as she had before. Absurd! And to make matters worse, he has become a part-time nursemaid and cook. But he doesn't know about any of these feelings. They are deeply buried in his unconscious, and to make sure that they stay there, he gets back pain. TMS. There was a large group of psychologists and doctors who would put a different interpretation on the young father's plight. They would say his back hurts from lifting the baby and not getting enough sleep. They would also say that the pain is very bad because he's trying to get out of doing his part with the baby. Now he has a good excuse. Of course, they say, this is all unconscious. This is the so-called secondary gain theory of chronic pain. The trouble with it is that first it presupposes a structural reason for the pain, which is usually untenable. Second, it elevates to preeminence a feeling that is either minor or non-existent, that the person is deriving some benefit from the pain. Behavioral psychologists like it, however, because it's simple and all you have to do is reward non-pain behavior and punish its opposite. There is no getting involved with messy, unconscious feelings like anxiety and anger. Years ago, before I knew about TMS, I tried this approach and found it singularly ineffective. Little wonder. It was the wrong diagnosis. All family relationships are emotionally loaded. It is one of the first things to be considered when someone has an attack of TMS that seems to come out of nowhere. The combination of real concern and love for the family member and inner resentment of the duties and responsibilities associated with the relationship are a source of deep conflict, the stuff of which TMS is made. Here is a classic story with some interesting sidelights about the natural history of TMS. The patient was a 39-year-old married man who ran a family business originally started by his father. He told me that his father was still active in the business, but that he had become a hindrance rather than a help. He admitted to conflict with his father over this and to feeling guilty about the whole thing. The pain syndrome had begun about 2.5 years before, and about 4 months into the experience, he read my first book. He decided it was hogwash and proceeded to make his way through the medical system, determined to get rid of the pain. He said he saw many doctors and tried virtually every available treatment with no success. 2 years later, he was still in pain, was rapidly becoming obsessed with it, and was extremely limited physically. He was afraid of any physical activity and could not even bend. At that point, he read the book again and reported with incredulity, "It had a totally different effect on me." He said he saw himself on every page. His explanation was that he had to go through all the tests and doctors before he was ready to acknowledge a psychological basis for the pain. Needless to say, he did very well on the program and was soon free of pain. During the consultation, I found him to be so perceptive and psychologically attuned, I could not imagine that he had originally rejected the diagnosis. It was a lesson to me. One of the unfortunate realities about working with a disorder like TMS is that most people will reject the idea until they are desperate for a solution. One of the great sources of conflict in the unconscious is the battle which rages between those feelings and needs that stem from narcissistic impulses and another very real part of the mind that is concerned about what is appropriate, reasonable, and mature, or even more demanding, with what you should be doing. The well-known psychoanalyst, writer, and teacher Karen Horney described what she called the tyranny of the should, which may dominate someone's life. Patients often describe in detail how their lives are governed by these behavioral imperatives. One woman told me, after denying that she was compulsive or perfectionistic, that she came from a family that prided itself on its strength of character and rigidity, stiff upper lip, and all that stuff. It was clear that there were other parts of her personality that were softer and more pliable, so the conflict in her unconscious must have been considerable. Sometimes the pressure to behave in a certain way comes from one's culture. I recall a strikingly attractive woman who was part of a religious group that believed in very large families. 6 or 8 children were not unusual. Though she acknowledged that her pain was due to tension, it persisted, and she couldn't understand why. I suggested that she might be resentful of the work and responsibility for such a large family. For a long time, she denied this, insisting that she felt no such resentment, and the pain continued, sometimes very severely. I pointed out that she would not be aware of the feeling since it was unconscious and repressed. Perseverance, both hers and mine, paid off. She began to get inklings of her deeply repressed resentment and then had a dramatic resolution of her symptoms. The longer I work with TMS, the more impressed I am with the role of anger. We have all learned to repress it so completely that we are totally unaware of its existence in many situations. In fact, I have concluded that anger is more fundamental to the development of symptoms than anxiety, and indeed, that anxiety itself may be a reaction to repressed anger. The following story made a deep impression on me. The man was in his mid-40s and, among other things, had a history of having occasional panic attacks. These represent acute anxiety. After having examined him and established that he had TMS, we discussed the psychology of the disorder. I told him that I was beginning to suspect that anger might be more important than anxiety. He said that something had just happened to him that supported that supposition. He had become extremely angry at someone and was on the point of starting an altercation when he decided that it would not be appropriate, that he had better swallow it. Within moments, he had a panic attack. He was probably more than angry. He was in a rage. And the need to repress it, both unconsciously and consciously, necessitated some kind of reaction, hence the panic attack. As we shall see in a moment, this is precisely the kind of situation that brings on TMS and other physical reactions. But first, let's consider the phenomenon of repression. Where does it come from? I remember a mother telling me proudly how she had stopped the temper tantrums in her little 15-month-old. Her supposedly, quote, wise family doctor suggested that she splash ice water in the child's face when he started to have a tantrum. It worked beautifully. He never had another tantrum. At the ripe age of 15 months, he had learned the technique of repression. He had been programmed to repress